Hi, everyone. Welcome to MusicWorksNYC.org. We have a very special guest, hopefully the first in a series of special topics we're going to discuss today. We have with us Ms. Shreya Raghuraman, who is of Indian descent, who has grown up in the United States, and who's going to talk to us about third culture experiences, meaning I'm going to let you explain what that means.
So third culture is a terminology that we use to kind of talk about the way in which folks who are growing up outside of their home country or outside of their parents' home country develop their lives. So it can be anything from just the way we talk, the way we do things, our experiences. And I think it's kind of a catch-all for a lot of different things, and no two third cultures are the same, but it's a shared experience that a lot of the global majority have when they move into dominated spaces by white people or in the West.
When someone asks you, "Oh, where are you from?" what is your immediate answer, and has that answer changed since you were a kid?
It is a very hard question to answer for me and for anybody. So I typically say, I'm from New Jersey, because it's kind of true. I mean, I went to middle school and high school in New Jersey. My parents still live in the state, so it feels right. But a lot of times, people have started to ask, where are you really from? In a way that sounds a little bit less offensive. They'll be like, oh, what about before that? And before that? and the real answer is, I was born in Mumbai in India, but my family is actually from South India. So we're from an area called Madras. And then we immigrated to the US when I was very young. I lived in Boise, Idaho. I lived in like five different cities in California. And then I landed up in New Jersey. So it's a very hard question to answer for all of those reasons.
People like myself who are sort of considered, like from everywhere and nowhere, when you have the privilege of being white, cisgender, male, part of the dominant culture, that sort of can cloud your identity or lack of, specific identity in a very anesthetizing way. It's like, well, I'm just from here because that's who I am and I belong here. And of course, I'd never say it, or most people would never say that, meaning anything consciously offensive, but it is a problem for someone like yourself who is from that mixture of cultures.
I had a hard time explaining to myself why I found that question kind of offensive. So I've been kind of thinking about it, and it comes from, when you ask someone where they're from, like, where are you really from? You're kind of othering the person. So you're saying, you're clearly not from here. So where is it so that I can classify you? Mm-hmm. And most of us, you and me, none of us fit into like one box or one category. And so it becomes a hard conversation to have, because you've already pushed me into a box in your head. You just need to put a label on it.
It's sort of like starting at a deficit from the beginning. I've been talking this week to people about disability. I've been in part of this great seminar about disability, and that came up immediately as that's sort of like when someone says, well, what's wrong with you? Or what doesn't work on you?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it.
What have been the different phases of you figuring out, who am I and where do I belong in this?
I mean, I'm an Indian American. So I was born in India. I'm a very proud of that heritage, but I'm also very much an American. And I think when I was younger, in my teen years or my early 20s, I had a lot of friction with that identity, where I was feeling like I was kind of cheating some sort of myself, even in the way that I talk. So, many third culture kids will have different accents in the different environments that they're in. And so I had my Indian accent, and I had my, Americanized English accent. And then there was like a range of accents in between those two. And I used to feel like I was cheating myself by wanting to feel more American, you know, more accepted in the norm by speaking the way that I am right now. And I think I've kind of come to terms with the fact that they're all me. So I am Indian, I am American, I am an East Coaster, I'm also sometimes a West Coaster. Like they're all true versions of me, and I think I spend less time now trying to pick one. They're all me. They're all me. They're all me.
Well, we're hoping to do a series including several topics that will get into the deeper meaning of some of these large questions we're jumping into. We are going to talk about accents quite a bit. Today we're going to talk about food. And you just said, you know, I am me, and I find less need or desire to choose each individual part. I am all those parts. And so I wanted to pivot a little bit. You started a really interesting project involving food and your family tree, and I wonder if you could introduce that now, and we'll get into some of the details and why that what you learned from that.
Growing up at home, we would eat Indian food, and it's very different from the Indian food you probably see at an Indian restaurant. So there's, you know, hundreds of different types of Indian cuisine, and the dominant one in American restaurants tends to be North Indian, very cream-based dishes. And there was a lot of shame that came with sharing that food with friends. You know, when I was a kid, my mom would pack me lunches often, and just sitting in the school cafeteria eating my quote-unquote smelly lunch. Mm-hmm. It really puts a toll on you, and the way in which you relate to the food that your mother is cooking for you.
You're talking now about being in elementary school and already feeling the pressure to conform, I shouldn't say the pressure to conform, but the awareness of your otherness. Bring yourself back to elementary school, Shreya, like you just opened your lunchbox, what's going on?
I mean, the dream was to find like a Lunchables in there, like the mm-hmm. cool kids, right? Mm-hmm. Or those Uncrustable peanut butter and jelly mm-hmm. situations. But oftentimes what I'd find was a beautiful homemade chapati, so like a rolled out thin flatbread, and probably rolled up with some curry, you know, mm-hmm. potatoes, pumpkin, whatever it might have been that day. Or my mom would make these idlis, which is like a fermented rice patty. And these things, you know, are pungent. They are amazing smells of healthy food that's good for you. But when they've been sitting in your lunchbox for a couple hours on a hot, you know, hot day, the whole cafeteria knows what you're eating by the time you open your box. And I just remember, you know, I would not eat my lunch. I would throw my lunch away because I was just so embarrassed by it. I would kind of secretly eat it in one corner and then go sit with my friends. There was a lot of very embarrassing things that I did now looking back. What's nice is, you know, my mom and I talk about this now, and she mentions like, yeah, it was kind of hurtful. And now meeting other Indian Americans, realizing that that's also a very common thing that a lot of kids went through.
I could just imagine her in the kitchen the night before packing this beautiful lunch for you and thinking, you know, like, this is the way I'm communicating love to my daughter, and I'm you know, helping her understand who she is and where she's coming from, and really just thinking, I'm doing the right thing here. And the disconnect in now hearing, and, you know, what your experience was like. What's the first time that you sort of like confided in someone, or what, like, got caught out, or what? Give me that scene in the movie where, you know, you get found out, you know, and you and your mom have the crying fight in the kitchen, and she says, "Well, I just love you." No, you don't have to tell me that scene. But,
no, that's the thing. Like, it wasn't one thing. This didn't happen for 1 year. This happened mm-hmm. for years, like mm-hmm. well past the time that I feel comfortable admitting now to everybody. Mm-hmm. Like, this fully baked idea in my head that the food that my mother packed me was like I could not eat
Right.
in a school or in a cafeteria environment. And so that crying scene in the kitchen happened not just once, but many, many times. Yeah, for some years my mom actually stopped packing lunch because it just became something that wasn't working. And it's a huge, huge regret on my part.
How did that feeling change when you were just with your family?
When I was younger, we were in communities where there were very few Indians. So that's when this feeling was really built inside of me and probably other kids. But by the time I was in high school, we were in a community with all of a sudden a lot of Indians. And I made my first couple Indian friends. And that was when I realized like, oh wow, like this is totally normal. Completely normal. Everybody has like, 10 different boxes or little pots of yogurt and rice sitting in their fridge. It's not just my family. And I think seeing others like me just opened a whole new door for me.
Yeah, seeing yourself in the world is so important, and it's really easy for someone like myself, who is part of the dominant culture, to realize that, because all I see is myself. As a teacher, for example, if I was in the lunchroom and I saw a kid who was kind of pushing their lunch off to the side or hiding it or whatever, and I would just think nothing of being like, "Oh, come on, that's great. Like, what an awesome lunch your mom packed for you. That's so cool." And like, with every well-intentioned
Yeah.
teacherly skill in my body, and yet really just having no clue of what goes into that kind of thinking.
Which brings me to kind of where I am now with food and the recipes that my family makes, where probably started a couple of years ago when I was in college and had to cook for myself for the first time. So that for everybody is like a learning process in and of itself. At that time, there were chefs like Priya Krishna, who is an Indian American writer and food editor, who published a book called or cookbook called Indianish, and they were all recipes that she made with her mother, and they were true to name Indian-ish. So she would make, nachos with an Indian twist, or she kind of she taught the Americans how to make things like dal and curry and yogurt. And I just remember thinking like, oh my God, like I spent all these years, not wanting to be a part of this or not appreciating all of this. And here's this awesome, food editor and woman who's one, completely owning it, and two, frankly, profiting off of it, which is incredible. Like I love that. And I think things like that just helped stoke this fire in me that like if I don't know my own heritage through food, like no one's gonna teach me. There's no Google website that will hold like my grandmother's dal when I want it 20 years from now, and no one's around to make it for me. It just started this need to learn how to do all the stuff that I'd taken for granted. And living at home during the pandemic the last year would just learn a lot of different recipes. And not just recipes, but the ways in which we think about health and food in Indian culture.
It sounds like you realized that you were sitting on this gold mine of culture, and not only that, but that you kicked the dirt and saw it and found it and decided to dig it up. That is just so awesome that you were able to flip that around, and move forward with like really taking ownership and agency of this heritage that you have. Do you remember like the first quote unquote lesson where you realized you were like, oh, like I'm actually learning something, like I'm tapping into something here?
My grandmother does live with us. She kind of splits her time between her children's homes in the US. I think it had less to do with what I was seeing in my house, because I'd always seen that, as my mom would, be cooking in the kitchen, and she would just make pretty much magic out of like one or two ingredients in the fridge. And I'd be like, where did you find this? And it had more to do with what I was seeing around me in the last couple of years, where these Indian practices are being commercialized. Coffee shops are selling turmeric milk, and they're charging $8 for it. There's Ayurvedic practices which are being, monetized and sold in terms of like eat your probiotic, have your yogurt, which are just things that I was born into. I don't have to buy into this at the store. I can just go open my mom's fridge, and all of that exists. And so it was kind of a kick in the butt to like start paying attention.
It sounds like, in a weird way, Americans have otherized these things that you just consider good common sense.
So a staple, very core dish in all of India, but predominantly South India, is yogurt rice. So we call it dahi shadam. Literally translates to yogurt rice. And really, it's you just mush up some rice, add some yogurt in it. You can thin it out a little bit, so it becomes a little bit, li liquidy. You eat it with some pickle, some curry, whatever it is. And I've been eating this since I was a kid. But there's a lot of health benefits to it. It's good bacteria. It's a probiotic. There's starch in the rice that you're combining with the probiotic to help make sure the probiotic doesn't die once it reaches your stomach. Like, there's all the science behind this very basic dish. And now I see, all these Instagram influencers talking about the magic of adding a probiotic pill into your non-dairy coconut yogurt and, a little bit of rice. Like, it's just, come on.
As a musician and a music educator, I will get these articles from time to time from a very well-meaning friend or family member, and it's always something like, new study shows that music can be really good for your math scores, or learning music helps you like excel in, and I always just want to write back like, no duh. Like, this is something that I've known intuitively for a very long time. And of course, these are very well-meaning people who are just sort of seeking to validate like what it is that I do, and usually they're music fans themselves. So, again, it's like no intentional harm, but that idea that like we've discovered some magic, I like that word, is like so silly in some ways. But it also, I would imagine, was very validating for you to just realize like, this is my culture, this is my heritage, like my people figured this out. What did your attitude on what was stocked in your kitchen change? Did you
I think
start seeing or
it's two
using?
things. I now understand how the ingredients are meant to be used and what the ultimate purpose of them is. So, when we make turmeric milk, for example, my mom would put black pepper in it when as she's boiling the milk, adding the turmeric in and cracking black pepper in. And I just assumed it was for taste. And turns out your body can't intake turmeric without the one of the chemical components that is in black pepper. It helps actually make the drink more healthy for you. And so when I'm in my own kitchen, I'm kind of thinking about all these things and having this different appreciation for how they all work together that I don't think I had before, and you can't get from reading a recipe. I'm also Indian-ish, and so when I'm making pasta, there are times when I'll just throw in curry powder and a couple other spices to make it a little bit my own. I'll put paneer on pizza, and there's a lot of like melding that happens, which is so lovely and frankly tastes so much better than either component individually. And so there's a lot of mashups that come out of my kitchen.
I know you just spent a summer in Brooklyn. This sort of like easy knock on a place like Brooklyn or New York City in general is that everything is just so darling, and artisanal. So it's like ingredients for ingredients' sake. It's just like, oh, well, this would be really hip and trendy if I put paneer on this pizza.
I will say about the artisanal food culture, you're totally right. I think that as long as it's an actual Indian profiting off the artisanal pickle and spices that are small batch, craft, artisanal, all of that good stuff, like more power to them. If it's someone who, if this is actually your culture and you're able to market it and hey, sell it for a profit, amazing. I think the problem comes, a couple weeks ago, there were headlines for a woman in the US whose company was to make congee, or as in East Asia, they call it congee. In South Asia, we pronounce it kanji. It's essentially rice porridge. But her marketing was basically like they enhanced congee and made it palatable for the Western world to eat congee, but better, which is like so ridiculous. It's not your food. You're not even giving any credit to where it comes from. I don't want you making money off of it.
To say you're going to westernize it, it's a little problematic. It's sort of implying that like it needs to be changed in the first place. Maybe Westerners might want to take a shot at like trying it out on their own. Like it might actually, but then to say we're going to make it better, yeah, that's like now you're really getting into dangerous territory.
The vast majority of Indian restaurants in the US are kind of that the mid-tier, not quite fast casual, but not, fine dining type of restaurant. And they, to your point, they typically cater to their white communities. And so you'll see a lot of very creamy, non-spicy, non-affronting dishes on the menu. You'll see, of course, naan, butter naan, garlic naan, whatever it is. But lately, I've been noticing a trend of more fine dining Indian establishments, which really excites me because fine dining as a category has never really been a place for these Asian cuisines. You think about your Chinese restaurants that they're kind of the corner restaurants on the street you go to get takeout from, and it's been the same for Indian restaurants. And so it's really exciting for me to see Indian chefs enter this arena of like Michelin stars, for example, and be able to, level up Indian food into that space in a really creative but still true to their roots way.
What is that experience like being Indian American and navigating restaurants that are mostly catered towards Americans?
I've definitely had that experience where I've, suggested an Indian restaurant with friends or whoever, and they've been like, "Oh, it just doesn't sit right with me in my tummy. Like, it's a little too heavy, too spicy." And I'm like, "That's because you've like have not been eating real Indian food your whole life. You've been eating cream, like heavy cream that was poured in your dish because, the Indian thought that you wanted that." The truth of the matter is, the things that I would maybe really want to eat or order probably aren't even on the menu at a Indian restaurant in a predominantly white community, unless I go into, Edison, New Jersey, where there are a ton of Indian restaurants and Indian people eating at those restaurants.
What is it like on a typical night in your mom's kitchen?
Everybody is expected in the kitchen when dinner is being cooked. Either you're unloading the dishes, you're doing the dishes, you're wiping the counter, you're cutting and peeling vegetables, whatever it might be. It's an all hands situation. I'm actually surprised my mom hasn't called me down yet to go help. I think, it's a community affair, right? And this is very common all over India. So in North India, there were these concepts of a langar or a community kitchen where people would come together and cook vast amounts of food for the community. this is not just a thing in my household. And those are the times where I think I will hold most fond, like the memories of my family, is like laughing over, you know, while my mom's at the stove, my dad's at the sink, my sister is like doing her homework at the table, and I'm whatever it is, observing, just watching the craziness of it all, at all. They're definitely the times that I felt just the most content during the pandemic, is having that time with my family.
Is there any one recipe that you got right or got wrong that sticks out in your mind as being like a pivotal learning experience? Was there a test you passed?
A couple years ago, you know, I had just a long week at work. I was living up in Boston, and I really wanted to make something Indian, and I didn't know what it was going to be. I was just a little bit homesick, a little bit tired, a little bit sad, frankly. And so I called my mom on a Saturday or Sunday morning, and I was just like, hey, can you, like, this is what I have in my fridge, teach me to make something. And she taught me to make her version of a dish called kadhi. And it's essentially a spiced, warm yogurt gravy, and typically doesn't have a lot of vegetables in it, but you can put, you know, chickpea dumplings or curry leaves, but it's typically just beaten as a side with rice and some vegetables. Not an easy recipe to learn over the phone. We were on FaceTime for some of it. We were on, you know, over text for some of it. But essentially she walked me through it, and I just remember sitting down kind of alone in my empty apartment, having that bowl of kadhi, just like so happy. That recipe was also very special for my mom, because it had been taught to her by a domestic help when she was growing up in India, who would make a lot of her lunches. And so we call it Manda's kadhi after her, whose name was Manda.
There was one time when we had some family from out of the country actually visiting. They were at our house. So I was living not at my mom's house, but separately. And we had a big day, and we got home, and it was like, there was this moment, and I said, you know, we could go out to eat if you want, or we could, if you want, we could just make something here. And these cousins of mine, Josh and Irit, are like famously happy people. Just anything you do, they're like, that was great, thank you so much. They're just so happy for anything. They're like the best guests. And Irit is also a very good cook. And she said, that would be fine. And Josh said, that'd be great. Anything you got would be great. So Irit and I, we have like spend very little time together. She lives across the world. And we just said, like, all right, we went into the cabinet and we started grabbing things. It was like the much more cozy version of some stupid reality show where they give you 60 minutes and you have to make something. And we put this thing together, and I remember it was so nice. It was so much fun. We made some kind of pasta thing. It was like, okay, it doesn't matter. You know, like, it was fine. Matter. Everybody liked it. But I remember afterwards she told my mom about it, and my mom was so excited. And I said, well, I learned that from you. Like, I learned how to do that from you, because that's kind of like the way it works in our kitchens.
Yeah. And you're so right. I love your story, because the best meals are like the ones that you make with someone you love, and they're quick and it's hot and you eat it because you're hungry. And those are the ones you remember. I think my favorite food memory ever has to be, you know, a month or two after I started my job. It was like my first big girl job out of college. I was working all the time, and I was traveling to a town called Malvern, Pennsylvania, and staying in a hotel a couple days out of the week there. It's a 2-hour drive from my parents' house in New Jersey. And I was just not having a great week. I'd worked a ton of hours. You know, I was ready to eat like the hotel bar food for the night. And my mom was like, we're going to come see you. And they drove on a weeknight, 2 hours to Malvern, Pennsylvania. And they picked me up from the hotel, and we went to a mall where they had a food court. And my mom like took out of her bag fully packed dinner for all of us. a tub of yogurt, roti, rice, curry, a dal. Like there's everything. And we ate in the mall food court with my dad, my mom, and my sister with our hands, which is like something that I could not imagine 10-year-old me ever doing in public. And it was probably the best meal I've ever had. Just because, I mean, I had a family who drove 2 hours there and 2 hours back just to feed me.
Well, we are certainly going to post some of Shreya's suggestions, places to look for interesting, elevated, and innovative Indian food culture and food commodities to be had. If we're lucky, we might get a recipe out of her, and I'd love to post that picture of that mall meal that you had. I want to thank our guest again, Shreya Raghuraman, for being here and sharing her unique take on the food culture and how it intersects with her sort of third culture status as she navigates through this world, and thank her. Thank you for your patience with me and my lack of questions, or my questions about the lack of understanding certain things. Before we go, can you give us, for someone who is just not connected to what they eat at all, can you give us your 30-second elevator pitch for why we should be invested in our food and the culture that it comes from?
There's the saying, we are what we eat. And it's supposed to be like a stupid saying, but it's so true. And the minute you start connecting to the ingredients, the way they work together, the way they appear on your plate, the way they go into your mouth, all of it. It's like you said, it's a form of therapy for me, and I'm sure it can be like that for many others. So it doesn't take much effort, right? You just have to start paying attention, and then it's pretty hard not to get sucked in. So food is therapy, food is medicine, food is everything.
Shreya, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Again, I'm Jesse Newman from MusicWorks NYC. You can find all kinds of resources for every age level and interest level at musicworksnyc.org. This is the Real Music Talk with MusicWorks podcast. Please take good care, and we'll see you soon.